Hi, I'm Frances Anderton. Thank you very much for listening to DNA. Just like the designs we spotlight on DNA, great care and creativity is taken in producing the stories on Unfictional. Intimate storytelling and artful documentaries crafted by some of the most talented radio producers across the world. Check it out, you'll enjoy it. Find Unfictional on KCRW's iTunes page. Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is KCRW's DNA. On this week's show, the California drought forces us to confront our unbounded consumption. Meanwhile, is the sky the limit for super-sized structures?
I asked one of the engineers who worked on the Burj Khalifa how tall you could really go. And he said, well, we could certainly double the size of the Burj Khalifa. And then, you know, after that, I don't know, we could work on doubling it again.
Justin Davidson talks later in the show about the advent of the mile-high skyscraper. And Panama Canal builds a third set of locks even as they consider adding a fourth. Before we get to that, though, for the first time in California's history, the governor has mandated a statewide cut in water use. What does this mean for the Golden State, its endless sense of possibility, and its endless green lawns? John Christensen is the editor of BOOM, a journal of California. He teaches at the Institute of the Environment and Sustainability at UCLA, and he's always seemed to me to be a sunny environmentalist. So what's his response to the dire drought reports?
Well, I think it's very serious, and we have to take it very seriously. This is a long drought we're in for now, a very long dry summer, even if we do get a little rain this week. but this is not new. We've experienced droughts before. We experience droughts from time to time in California. We're a boom and bust environment, as well as often a boom and bust economy. And so I do think it's a time to take this seriously. What I worry about is that it seems to bring out, as it always does, the shamers, the guilt trippers, and the blame gamers. That is, you know, Californians are always looking for somebody else to blame for our dire predicament. And when we get into these serious droughts, the North blames the South, the urban folks blame farmers, farmers blame the cities. Now we've got a lot of people blaming wealthy people for using more water. And, you know, I think this is one of the great myths that there's in California water, is that there's some villain that we can identify who is the cause of it, and if we solve that, we'll be okay. It's just not that way. Californians got in this altogether by voting for these big water projects, by building, you know, cities and, you know, some of the greatest agriculture in the world, and we'll only get out of it together.
So we can only get out of this together. We can't make this a blame game. How do we do this?
There's a very vibrant conversation going on in Los Angeles now about changing landscaping. There's incentives for changing landscaping, making our cityscape more absorbent of water so we're letting less of it wash out to the sea and we're reusing and recycling, you know, being more responsible in our relationships with the Owens Valley, with the Delta of the Sacramento-San Joaquin, planning better to balance that portfolio of water that we get from those areas, making our homes more water efficient and more pleasant for the environment that we live in, using less energy and water, making our public spaces the same. You know, so there's a lot of things that we can do and that I think are happening. And I think it would be good to recognize and focus, you know, on those things. Perhaps that's my, you know, glass half full attitude.
Well, I remember as a child back in England, we actually had a drought, believe it or not. And what was the motto or the slogan that the government put out? Save water, bath with a friend.
Yes. You know, I think if we lose sight of the fact that it has to be about fun and beauty, that we won't have the kind of, you know, esprit de corps that we need to really move these changes. I think the other thing that's lacking, not from Jerry Brown right now, I mean, it is leadership. One of the things that really made possible these big projects, the LA Aqueduct, the Boulder Canyon Dam, the Central Valley Project, and, you know, particularly the State Water Project with Jerry Brown's father, who made it a very personal project, was that kind of passionate leadership that would articulate a direction for us to go. It's somewhat simpler when you have just one big project, one big solution to propose. The times are different. As a historian, I recognize that. But I don't see the leadership emerging that is really driving this conversation.
So in some ways, could this alarm sounded by the governor sort of concentrate the mind about who we are and where we live, give us a sense of being authentically Californian?
I do think that the governor's announcement is concentrating our minds on where we live and how we should live and how we get through this. But I hope that it doesn't just become a long summer of denial and of, you know, blaming each other. I hope that out of this, there will also be voices for creative, beautiful solutions.
Well, John Christensen, always a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Well, likewise. Thank you.
John Christensen is editor of BOOM, a Journal of California. I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA, Design and Architecture. So we want to know about your creative drought solutions. We're creating a gallery of images on our blog of the many and varied drought-tolerant gardens springing up around LA. So send us your succulent selfies, your snapshots of gorgeous gravel, rock, and cactus compositions. Post them on Instagram or Twitter with the hashtag DroughtGarden. Now onto another country and a mighty engineering project, Panama and its famous canal. The Panama Canal was built at the same time as the LA Aqueduct, and it represented the growing might of the Pacific. It turned 100 last year and is now in the midst of an expansion that is meant to open next year and keep it in business for many years to come.
At one stage, they were 4 or 5% of world trade. They've gone down to 3%, and they were going to get even smaller unless they supersize the canal. And so that's the major thing they've done. They've actually really provided more than double the capacity by putting new locks.
That's Mike Newbury. He's vice president at the engineering firm MWH Global, and he's project design manager for the third set of locks. But can the Panama Canal keep up with the container ship building boom that has ports from the West Coast to the East busy rebuilding? Hear from Long Beach about mega ships in a moment. Before that, though, let's take a breath and consider the ongoing construction in Panama. The locks, one at the Atlantic side and another at the Pacific side, are 1,400 feet long and 60 feet deep. Each will have three chambers with water-saving basins, and the Gatun Lake is being deepened. The construction process has been documented in Panama Canal Supersized, a film that airs this Saturday on the History Channel. It's by Los Angeles filmmakers Bill Ferrahawk and Dylan Robertson, and it was commissioned initially as a promotion for MWH, but caught the imagination of the History Channel. The goal, says Dylan Robertson, was to make the slow process of building exciting.
We do a lot of work for PBS, and from the outset, this was a History Channel show, and they said, you know, they wanted a different style. And so, all right, we're going to make this. We actually took our cue from sports documentaries, and one of the things about sports documentaries that got really excited is they pinpoint and compress action. A quarterback will drop back, raise the football back, and the moment will compress in that moment. And we thought, oh, if we could do that and give it that energy and joy and fun and pace, so we'll focus on the install of a gate right down to the second it crosses the corner, you know, 10 stories high, and they have an inch on either side, you're there for that moment, and it is dramatic in that way.
So the filmmakers used time-lapse photography and whizzy graphics and lots of dynamiting of rock to make drama out of the installation of the lock gates, the steel construction, and even soil texture.
And when the rains mix with the Atlantic soils, things can get messy.
If it gets wet, it turns to mush more or less, and it's a sloppy soup of material. We've had several machines that have sunk above the axles in the muck.
Despite these punishing conditions, crews press on with their mission.
Until conflict arises with the steel.
One of the key elements they move is steel. But steel has an enemy. Salt water. If salt water comes into contact with steel, it will corrode and fail. A potential catastrophe. That's where concrete comes in.
But the biggest challenge of all comes with the gate installation.
The challenge of installing these gates into their designated recess is not too dissimilar from trying to move a couch into your apartment through a narrow doorway. I think if you get halfway in, you're home. But it's a very tight tolerance. Inches.
If you've watched architectural engineering documentaries, you'll know they usually hinge for excitement on the epic human story of the willful client or the driven designer. But in this film, there are no strong human characters because the locks are the character.
The locks are the character because the Panama Canal is in danger. If it doesn't get upgraded, no one's going to use it in 20 years because that's how economics are changing. And when we started to sit down and we did our preliminary research with Mike Newberry and MWH Global, a lot of the engineers, we realized, oh, you need to make locks that can take the Empire State Building, tip it on its side, put it in a bathtub, and fill that bathtub in 10 minutes, but don't use pumps. That is an incredible challenge. Oh, by the way, that has to... You have to fill it up within 4 inches of the fill line, otherwise the gates can't open. It has to run 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for 50 years. When we started to hear these immense challenges that the engineers were facing, we felt that's the story that's so amazing and is how do you think of these answers? How do you do it? How do you come up with these solutions that I think is sort of fun that puts the audience in the seat of how would I design a solution for that? You know, what would I do? What would I think of?
That was Dylan Robertson. The film is a lively, watchable depiction of the making of an amazing structure. But the very fact it's being built is to allow the passage of ever larger container ships to move more of our stuff for less money. So I had to ask the directors and Mike Newberry, did they find themselves reflecting on the consumption that has caused things to go so big? First up, Bill Ferrahawk.
For this story, it's not a piece of the story. But I do think that the shipping, I think what's interesting is these ships have been around for a while. These are not anything really new. In fact, there are much, much bigger ships currently being built now in Korea and in China. So I think it is interesting to reflect just on where we are. And maybe this gives us an opportunity to reflect on global trade as a whole and how it relates to our personal lives. I think that's important. Yes.
The fundamental question I can't really answer. It's a bigger question. You know, should we be expanding to allow unlimited growth? But from my perspective, the Panama Canal expansion allows more efficient transportation of at least the goods that we currently are using and want and would need anyway. And so that's at least there's a reduction in emissions and there's efficiencies in the supply chain because of the Panama Canal. The expansion part or the increased capacity, that's a more fundamental question.
There's a lot of talk of supersizing. People generally love things bigger, bigger, bigger. And for you, is there kind of a limit ever to a civil engineering project of this nature?
I think it would be a very wise man that could predict that. Certainly, there's not a limit to the Panama Canal. There's discussions ongoing about the fourth set of locks, which would be even larger than the ones we've just designed. So obviously we're very interested in talking to the Panama Canal Authority about helping with that. But obviously when you're looking at civil works projects, you want to try and have to balance the impact of the project with the impact to the environment. And so I would imagine that some of these large projects will be limited perhaps by their environmental impacts rather than the physical design limitations. I'm sure we could design something bigger, but many of them won't be built because it's not going to be socially acceptable.
Mike Newberry is vice president at the engineering firm MWH Global, and he's project design manager for the third set of locks currently under construction at the Panama Canal. Panama Canal Supersized, directed by Bill Ferrahawk and Dylan Robertson, airs this Saturday evening on the History Channel. You're listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. So we wanted to find out more about what's going on in the global shipping race. Exhibit A is our own port of Long Beach, which is currently spending several billion dollars dredging deeper waters, upgrading its terminals and building higher cranes and a new bridge to make room for taller, larger ships. We headed to one of the port's terminals and met Lee Peterson, spokesman for the port.
We're standing here on Pier J. We're looking at two ships at berth right now at the Pacific Container Terminal. It's a beautiful view right now. You have the morning light, which is great for photography, as everybody knows, and you have a nice stillness of the channel here and these huge ships being worked by these massive cranes. It's a great sight. It's magnificent.
So describe those ships. They're pretty big.
These are two ships. There's the CMA CGM Vela, which is an 11,000 container unit vessel. And there's also the Hanjin Buda, which is a 10,000 container unit vessel. About 7 years ago, 8,000 container unit ship was considered a mega ship, as we talk about now. And these days at the Port of Long Beach, we're having up to 14,000 container unit ships that visit us.
And that is creating quite a race for these ports to see who becomes big ship ready first.
Noel Hasegaba is Managing Director of Commercial Operations at the Port of Long Beach.
The Port of Long Beach is a leader in that race. And we began investing in our infrastructure years ago with the idea of welcoming these big ships. Already, we are seeing 14,000 TU vessels coming to Long Beach regularly. By the end of this year, the Port of Long Beach will be able to accommodate ships as large as 20,000 TU. And that's by virtue of one of our biggest projects under development called Middle Harbor. Middle Harbor will become the nation's fourth largest port in terms of capacity.
Do you think there's any kind of limit in sight on these ships?
As far as we know, there are 24,000 TU vessels on the drawing board. How soon or when that growth will stop is not known to us.
So just to wrap up, to go back to where we started, Panama Canal, what you're saying is it's not the only game in town.
The Panama Canal, we don't view it as a game changer. The real game changer is the pace at which these ships are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And the Port of Long Beach is big ship ready today. And when the Panama Canal opens up, we will already be seeing ships calling Long Beach that will not be able to transit the new canal.
That was Noel Hasegaba, Managing Director of Commercial Operations at the Port of Long Beach. TEU, by the way, is the industry term for the capacity of storage containers and means 20-foot equivalent unit. So the Panama Canal may not be a game changer, but it's an engineering marvel that still stirs the blood, to the point that Disney takes cruises there. George Scribner is a Disney Imagineer who grew up in Panama, and now he's going back there for the Panama Canal Authority to paint the process of the expansion.
I grew up with the canal and thought, I didn't really think that much of it. As I got older and older, I grew to appreciate it. And I guess the larger appeal to me, and maybe it's what appealed to others, these large, massive projects. We're thinking beyond our own generation, that we're generations out in our approach. And I find that greatly appealing. The idea of making a canal goes back hundreds of years, this idea of connecting the oceans. How we got there? Yeah, not pretty. And how we arrived at making Panama an independent republic and what was done, those you can't argue. It's like, really? You had to do it that way? You couldn't have done it some other more elegant way? But I point to what Panama's doing with the canal expansion, and I think they have learned that legacy. For every hectare of land that has been set aside for the locks and the channels and on both sides, on the Atlantic and Pacific sides, on a one-to-one basis, they are reforesting parts of Panama on a one-to-one basis. It's very forward-thinking.
Mm-hmm. And the Panama Canal still sort of so stirs the imagination that people, it's a destination, it's a tourist destination. Your own company, Disney, takes people on cruises there. What do they see?
I have spoken on, I did one transit. It was it's an 8-hour transit. I went on one of the ships and spoke 6 or 7 times on various aspects of it. And they ride from, in this case, it was northbound, north to south. We were running southbound. We entered the Gatun, or the Atlantic Chambers, early in the morning, and everyone's up. They're dumbstruck at the scale, the size of these locks. I think people today are still stunned in the middle of this rainforest around these massive concrete structures, 3 chambers leading up to a freshwater lake. It's an ingenious design.
You're saying that for Panama, this is a source of great national pride.
It's an enormous national pride. You know, the Americans had their effort. This is now no toca ahora. It's our turn.
George Scribner is a Disney Imagineer. He's painting the process of the construction of the Panama Canal. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. Coming up after this break, the dream of the Mile High Tower may be coming closer. But why do we need it?
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. Nearly 60 years ago, Frank Lloyd Wright designed a 528-story high tower called the Illinois to be built in Chicago. That was a dream. But now a kilometer high tower is going up in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, topping the Burj Khalifa in Dubai, which stands at over half a mile. Engineers say Wright's dream is now technically possible. But do we need it? Justin Davidson is architecture and classical music critic at New York Magazine, and he's just published an article called The Rise of the Mile High Building. He says these extremely high-rise towers are not driven by economics.
The impulse to build high, to build skyscrapers, from the beginning of the skyscraper era was an economic one. It was about maximizing the value of land. And the idea was that essentially you can multiply the value of land by stacking people and uses and spaces one on top of the other. And the higher you can go, the more money you can make from that land. It's a profoundly anti-agricultural way of thinking about land. At a certain point, technology and society have run into these stumbling blocks where you really couldn't go any higher either because the technology wasn't there or because it simply became too expensive. And then you kind of hit this barrier and then there would be another economic or technological barrier passed and you could keep on going higher. We're at a point now where we really don't know technologically what the limits of building high are. The Kingdom Tower in Jeddah in Saudi Arabia is projected to be a kilometer high, so not quite a mile. But it's easy to imagine a mile high tower, which would be considerably taller than that. Everybody I've talked to suggests that it's technologically feasible. The big question is why? Because what happens is as you go higher, the possibility of making money from each of those higher levels decreases. So there are other non-rational, non-economic motivations that come into play.
Well, you said there's been these certain points in the evolution of the skyscraper that have been, I think you used the word inflection points, where all of a sudden there's a jump. Are we in that one of those points right now?
For a long time, there was kind of an incremental increase in the height of buildings. And you kind of wondered why. I mean, you know, there would be another few stories, another 30 or 40 feet. And it was really just a kind of progression of one-upsmanship. And around 2000, you start to get these much bigger leaps from Taipei 101 to the Burj Khalifa, then to the Kingdom Tower, which is under construction now. And they really are, each one is kind of a different kind of structure and really not an order of magnitude, but really a big jump of several hundred feet up. And when you look at what engineers have learned from that experience, it's clear that you can extend that to really much bigger jumps. I mean, I asked one of the engineers who worked on the Burj Khalifa how tall you could really go. And he said, well, we could certainly double the size of the Burj Khalifa. And then, you know, after that, I don't know, we could work on doubling it again. So it's really the limitations are economic and social now.
But you do enumerate in your article, which is very interesting. You've talked to lots of engineers. You do enumerate a number of physical challenges. Some of them are being surpassed. One of them has to do with elevators. There's also the impact of weather. But what you're outlining is some quite complex engineering to render more comfortable an extremely high tower that nobody knew they needed. Is that sort of what this is about? I mean, to your knowledge, is there a strong impulse among regular folk, not the engineers or the clients of these buildings, but to be a mile high in the air? Is that something many of us dream of?
Well, clearly, it's a very small market, and it has to be, because you're never going to get a lot of these buildings. And because the cost of building at those levels means the premium for residences up at those heights has to be so extraordinary that really only a few people in the world could afford to live there. So not only have you narrowed your market to people who can afford, you know, unlimited, to spend unlimited amounts on the place they live, but also narrowed that population down to people who are comfortable living way up high. So high, as a matter of fact, that in many cases, the theoretical expansiveness of the view is, you know, neutralized by the fact that, you know, you're actually up there in the weather and might not be able to see down below the clouds or, you know, much of the view beyond. If you think about approaching an airport as you're landing in a plane and going from kind of sunlit upper level where, you know, the sky is always clear, and then you go through the clouds. Well, that passage through the clouds is kind of where you might be living in one of those towers. So there is this kind of jack-in-the-beanstalk quality. So, no, I don't think that this is something that is meeting a wide demand. It can't, really, and it's one of the things that makes, I think, this era in tower building really different from the past. Because if you think about the Empire State Building and towers of that generation, they were really huge work machines. They were ways of packing large numbers of people comfortably into a very small area of the city, making it possible for them to get in and out of the building quickly, to get to work more efficiently, to maximize productivity. So, you know, in those buildings, you have thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of people working. When you're talking about buildings that are as high as the ones we're talking about and the taper to where really the only practical use is of residences, not workspaces, then you're talking about, you know, one person in a triplex penthouse two-thirds of a mile above the earth who may only live there part-time anyway. So as a generator of efficiency, it leaves something to be desired.
Well, and then we get back to the starting point of our conversation, which is, again, the why. Why this kind of competitive, this need to keep one-upping with the height?
Well, you know, I would say that it's easy to laugh at the competitive urge or the sort of ego-boosting drive in architecture. But look, if we didn't have that, you know, if vanity hadn't always been part of the human condition, just think about all of the other monuments that we wouldn't have. I mean, you know, what were the pyramids except the, you know, expression of vanity realized at immense cost both to the slave laborers who built it and to the public treasury? And, you know, go around the world and many of the buildings we value most have no real purpose except to glorify their builders or do so through a kind of form of devotion. Ultimately, there is a deep strain of irrationality in architecture, which I think belongs there. I don't think it's something that we should be sneering at. Sometimes it gets preposterous, but it does get hard to distinguish between what is kind of a virtuous form of vanity that's going to produce great monuments, and what is a silly form of vanity that's just going to produce duds on a very large scale.
Justin Davidson is classical music and architecture critic at New York Magazine. His most recent piece is The Rise of the Mile High Building. I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. And that's it for today's show. It was produced by Caroline Chamberlain and mixed by Ray Guana. Special thanks to Jason Groman. Find more DNA on our blog at kcrw.com/DNA. And follow us on Facebook at KCRW's Design and Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton. Thank you very much for listening.